tune. According to Lion King, there was about an hour to go before we arrived. I sat there feeling rather pleased the chocolate had worked and that I wouldn't have to waste time in Narva waiting for nature to call. I dry-swallowed another 4 aspirin and looked out of the window. No wonder people had been getting off before entering this part of the country. This must be the start of the great industrial northeast the Soviets had created during their reign. Gone were the trees and open spaces of the wilderness. Instead, the view consisted entirely of slag heaps, with massive conveyor belts and factories that churned out smoke from every corner. We trundled past forbidding blocks of flats, with TV aerials hung from every window and sometimes enormous, outdated satellite dishes. There were no gardens or play areas, just 2 or 3 cars up on concrete blocks. Even the snow was grey. The scenery didn't change much as the stops became more frequent, except that every spare inch of ground along the track was covered with little vegetable allotments. Even the spaces under electricity pylons were turned into makeshift greenhouses, using a patchwork of plastic sheeting. Just when I thought it couldn't get any more depressing, the train shunted past 3 cars parked at the side of the road, nose to tail. They were riddled with bullet holes and burned out. There was no snow or ice on them, and shattered glass lay all over the place. It looked as if they'd only just been hosed down and torched. For all I knew, there might still be bodies inside. A couple of kids walked past and didn't give them a second look. The train stopped with a judder and a loud squeal of brakes. We seemed to be in a rail yard. Fuel, bowsers and freight cars appeared on either side, all covered with Russian script and caked in oil and ice. I was back in a scene from a Harry Palmer film again. Only Michael Caine would have had a suit and trench coat on, instead of piss-stained jeans. The train just seemed to have driven into the yard and stopped, and that was it. Going by the number of doors opening, it was time to get off. Welcome to Narva. I looked out of the window and saw people jumping down onto the tracks with their carrier bags. The only other remaining passenger in my carriage was leaving. I did the same, traipsing through the snow across a massive shunting yard, following the others towards an old stone house. I guessed that it hadn't been built until after 1944, because I'd read that when the Russians liberated Estonia from the Germans, they flattened the whole town, then rebuilt it from scratch. I went through grey-painted metal double doors into the ticket office. The room was only about 20 by 30 feet, with a few old plastic classroom-style chairs around the sides. The walls were covered with the same thick, shiny grey paint as the doors, onto which graffiti had been scratched. I thought the floor was plain pitted concrete until I noticed the 2 remaining tiles refusing to leave home. The ticket office was closed. A large wooden board was fixed to the wall near the sales window, with plastic sliders upon which, in Cyrillic, were the names of various destinations. I looked for anything that resembled the word Tallinn. It seemed that the first train back was at 08:22 each morning. But even if they'd spoken English, there was no one around to confirm it. I stepped round the obligatory puddle of vomit and came out of the main entrance. Over to my left was what I took to be a bus station. The buses were of 1960s or 1970s vintage, all battered and some even hand-painted. People were fighting to get aboard, exactly as they'd done in the capital. The driver was shouting at them, and they shouted at each other. Even the snow was exactly the same as in Tallinn, dirty, downtrodden, and viciously icy. Digging my hands deep into my pockets, I cut directly across the potholed road, following the map in my head along Puskini, which seemed to be the main street. It wouldn't be far to Konstantin's address. Puskini was lined on either side by high buildings. On the left, what looked like a power station loomed behind them and, bizarrely, electricity pylons were set into the street and pavements, so pedestrians had to pick their way round them. Russians seemed to have sited all their industrial units as near as possible to the stations that powered them. Then, if they had any space left, they'd squeezed in accommodation for the workers. And fuck the people who had to live there. I'd seen enough to tell me this was a miserable, run-down place. The newest buildings looked as if they dated from the 1970s, and even they were falling apart. I headed up the street, keeping to the right. It was quiet apart from the occasional tractor and one or two Russian-plated articulated lorries surging past. The roads and pavements were jet black with grease and grime, with a good coating of slush from passing vehicles. Christmas hadn't arrived in Narva yet. I wondered if it ever would. There were no street decorations, lights, or anything remotely festive, even in the windows. I walked past drab shop fronts, which advertised everything from second-hand washing machines to Arnold Schwarzenegger videos. Further along, I came to a small mini-market. It was an old building, but had the brightest lighting I'd yet seen spilling out onto the iced pavement. I couldn't resist it, especially as I hadn't had anything to eat since my chocolate and meat combo, from which I'd long since parted company. An old man was lying on top of a cardboard box to one side of the main entrance, sheltered by the shop's canopy. His head was wrapped in rags, his hands covered with strips of canvas. The skin on his face was dark with ingrained dirt, and he could have grown vegetables in his beard. Beside him was a wooden tomato box turned upside down, displaying a rusty old screwdriver and a pair of pliers that were clearly up for sale. He didn't bother looking up at me as I passed. I must have looked as though I was all right for rusty tools. The store was laid out to exactly the same template as a small-town spa in the UK. It even had some of the same brands. Colgate toothpaste, KP nuts, and Gillette shaving foam. But not much else, apart from crates of beer and a large chiller cabinet that had nothing in it except rows of different sausages, including the dodgy red ones I hadn't eaten on the ferry, strung out in lines to make the display look more generous. I picked up a family-sized bag of crisps, two packs of sliced processed cheese, and four cake-type rolls. I didn't bother with a drink, as I hoped I'd soon be getting a hot one at Constantine's. Besides, there wasn't much choice apart from beer and half bottles of vodka. I couldn't be asked to get washing kit or a toothbrush to replace the stuff that had been stolen. All that sort of thing I'd grab if I needed it. But I didn't plan to be in country that long. And in any case, no one I'd seen so far seemed to give much of a shit about personal hygiene. As I paid for my goods, I helped myself to two carrier bags, putting one pack of cheese and a couple of rolls into one, the rest into the other. Passing the old guy on the way out, I put the smaller bag down beside him. I hadn't bought him any crisps because I didn't think his gums could tackle them. I knew what it felt like to spend hours outside in the cold. With hands back in my jacket pockets, the bag dangling from my right wrist and banging rhythmically against my thigh, I moved on. I skirted a pylon that was half in the street and half over the wall of a small factory. And more rows of miserable flats came into view, identical to the ones I'd seen from the train. There were no names on the blocks, just stenciled numbers. At last, I'd found one thing that my old council estate had over this place. At least every building there had been named after locations in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. The rest of it, though, was much the same. Rotting wooden window frames and cracks in the panes taped over with parcel tape. I remembered why I'd promised myself at the age of 9 that I'd get out of shitholes like this as soon as I could. It was only about 1:30 in the afternoon, but already the town could have done with some streetlights on. Unfortunately, there just weren't that many around to help out. Things started to liven up after another 100 meters or so. I came to a giant car park full of buses and cars. People who seemed to be carrying everything from carrier bags to suitcases were shouting at each other, trying to be heard over the noise of air brakes and engines. It looked like news footage of refugees moving through a checkpoint. The closer I got, the more it started to look like somewhere Han Solo might go to get a spare part for his spacecraft. There were some strange-looking people around. I realized I was at the border crossing point, the road bridge into or out of Russia. Harry Palmer would have been a regular here. The car park was clogged with new Audis, old BMWs and Ladas of all sorts, shapes and ages. It was the Fort Sierras that looked strangely out of place. There were fleets of the things. I now knew where all the second-hand ones went when they weren't snapped up by minicab drivers. Money changers plied their trade along the edges of the car park, and kiosks sold all other types of kit as fast as Chad could manufacture it. I walked over to a green-painted garden shed with a small sliding window, dodging the Arctic trucks that thundered past as they cleared border control. If you didn't get out of the way, tough. Camel, Marlboro, and a million different Russian brands were taped to the glass, together with as many different styles of lighter. An old guy who looked like a gypsy, dark-skinned with thick, grey, curly hair, showed me his list of exchange rates. It seemed I could get about 12 eek, whatever they were, to the US dollar. I didn't know if that was good or not, just that Duracell batteries were taped up at just a couple of eeks each. So either it was the bargain of the century, or they were duds. I didn't want to show that I had money, so I went and sat on a dustbin behind the kiosk, got a warm $100 bill out of my sock, and replaced the boots pretty sharpish. Once he'd carried out about 5 different checks to make sure it wasn't counterfeit, including smelling it, the old guy was very happy indeed with his hard currency. And so was I with my new eek wedge. I left the refugee camp behind and headed further up Puskini, towards a roundabout which, according to the map in my head, led to the road I wanted. The only buildings that looked at all inviting were near the roundabout. Flashing neon signs told me these were comfort bars. Music blared from loudspeakers rigged up outside. Originally, I suppose they'd been ordinary bars or shops, but their windows were painted out now. It didn't need much imagination to work out what was on offer the other side of the emulsion. But for the benefit of anyone in doubt, there were pictures of women and Cyrillic stenciling, no doubt defining exactly what was meant by comfort. The best picture of all was on a blue window, showing the Statue of Liberty with Marilyn Monroe's face, pulling up her robe to reveal an ace of spades between her legs. Underneath, in English, it read, "America, fuck it here." I wasn't too sure what it all meant, but the Russians who had parked up all the trucks along the road obviously didn't have any trouble reading the menu. I'd just stopped by the roundabout to check which road I wanted next when 2 white Suzuki Vitaras with flashing red and blue light bars screeched to a halt outside Marilyn's. 3 guys pulled out of each, dressed exactly the same as the SWAT team at Tallinn Station, but with a different logo. Theirs was also sewn on the back of their bomber jackets. I couldn't make out the wording from this distance, just that it was all in red and in the sort of typeface used on surfwear. Pulling out smaller truncheons than the lot at the station, they piled into the bar. I stepped into a doorway to watch, taking one of the rolls from my carrier bag. Pulling the bread apart, I threw in a few slices of cheese and a handful of crisps, and watched as a very tired-looking green larder police car turned up and parked near the Vitaras. 2 fur-hatted figures inside didn't get out. I stamped my feet to keep them warm. The Vitaras were showroom clean and had a phone number and logo emblazoned on the side and what looked like the letters DTTS. The police car was falling to pieces and looked as if the insignia on the side had been hand-painted. For the next few minutes, nothing much happened. A stream of vehicles negotiated the roundabout and I ate my roll, along with a few more crisps. A few of the passing cars were quite new. Audis, VWs, and even a Merc. But not many. The popularity battle was really between clapped-out Sierras and Larders. I was still putting the finishing touches to my second cheese roll when the black teams emerged from the bar, dragging out 3 punters between the 6 of them. All 3 were in suits, with blood pouring down their faces onto their white shirts, while their smart shoes got scraped along the ice. They were thrown into the back of the Vitaras and then given the good news with truncheons. The doors were closed, and one of the team, noticing the police car, just waved them away. None of the passers-by even bothered to glance at what was going on. It was hard to tell whether they were too scared or just couldn't be asked. The police headlights came back on, and off they drove, exhaust pipe rattling, towards the border crossing car park. The Vitaras and their crews also left, and I finished the roll as I crossed the roundabout and turned right towards the river. The address that Liv had given me was on this road, which was known simply as Viru. Still wondering what the three guys had done to cause Marilyn such offence, I started attacking the last roll, and the remaining cheese and crisps. Like I didn't have my own stuff to worry about. Chapter 31 Viru wasn't any more uplifting than the rest of the town. Just grey, miserable blocks of housing. More black snow and more uncared-for roads. Then bizarrely, just up ahead was a burned-out Dodgem car, its metal frame and long conducting rod charred and twisted. God only knows how it had got there. The only thing moving was a posse of five or six dogs, creating a haze of steam above their bodies as they skulked around, sniffing at stuff on the ground, then pissing on it. I didn't even feel bad as I dropped my plastic bag, along with the crisp and cheese packets. When in Rome. Now and again a patched-up Sierra clattered past on the cobblestones, its occupants looking at me as if I was mad to be walking in this neighbourhood. They were probably right, if the sulphur fumes I was inhaling were anything to go by. There was obviously another environmentally friendly factory nearby. Slipping my hands deeper into my pockets and my head deeper inside my collar, I tried to adopt the same miserable body language as everyone else. Thinking about what I'd seen at the comfort bar, I decided not to tangle with private enterprise security if I could help it. The state police looked a softer option. Viru started to bend to the right, and straight ahead I could see the icy riverbank, 500 or 600 meters away. That was Russia. As I neared the bend, I could see into the gorge, with the river Narva about 200 meters below. Following it round, the road bridge was about 400 meters away. Lines of cars were queuing to leave Estonia, with foot traffic moving in both directions, carrying suitcases, carrier bags and all sorts. The checkpoint on the Russian side had barriers across the road and guards checking papers. If the numbering on the map was correct, number 87, Viru, would soon be on my right, a little past the bend and facing the river. It wasn't an apartment block as I'd been expecting, but a large old house that was now a bar. At least, that was what the sign said, in white but unlit neon lettering above a rotten wooden door. Big patches of rendering were missing from the front of the building, exposing the red clay brick underneath. It was 3 stories high, and looked really out of place amongst the uniform concrete blocks surrounding it on 3 sides. Most of the upper windows were covered by internal wooden shutters. There were no curtains to be seen. There was another neon sign, also not illuminated, of a man leaning over a pool table with a cigarette in his mouth and a glass of beer on the side. According to the sign next to it saying 8 to 22, it should have been open. Trying the door handle, I found that it wasn't. 4 cars were parked up outside. There was a brand new shiny red Audi, and 2 Cherokee Jeeps that had seen better days, both dark blue and with Russian plates. The 4th vehicle, however, was in the worst state of any I'd seen in Estonia, apart from the Dodgem. It was a red Lada that had been hand-painted and had to belong to a teenager. There were domestic music speakers clamped on the back shelf, from which wires hung like spaghetti. Very cool, especially the pile of old newspapers on the back seat. I looked through the grime-covered ground-floor windows. There were no lights on, and no sounds. Walking round to the other side facing the river, I could see a light shining on the 3rd floor. Just a single bulb. It was like finding life on Mars. Back at the wooden door, I hit the intercom button near the bar sign. The building might be in as shit state as Tom's, but the intercom was in better condition. There was no way of telling if it was working, though, so I tried again, this time for longer. There was static and crackling, and a gruff male voice, half-aggressive, half-bored, quizzed me. I didn't know what the fuck he was on about. I said, "Konstantin. I want to see Konstantin." I heard the Russian or Estonian equivalent of, "Eh? What?" Then there was more gobbing off from him, and voices shouting in the background. When he came back to me, it was with something that obviously translated as, "Fuck off, big nose." The static ceased. I'd been given the brush off. I buzzed again, working on the theory that if he got pissed off enough, he might come down to the door to fill me in. At least then, I had a chance of making some progress. There was more shouting, which I didn't understand. I got the gist, but carried on regardless. "Konstantin! Konstantin!" The machine went dead once again. I wasn't sure whether there was going to be some action now or not, so I stayed where I was. After about 2 minutes, there was the sound of bolts being thrown on the other side of the door. I moved out of the way as it was pushed open. Behind it was an iron grill door, still closed. And behind that was a guy of maybe 17 or 18, who looked like the style fairy had crept up on him and waved her L.A. street gang wand. I bet he owned the lather. "Do you speak English?"
"Yo. You want Konstantin?"
"Yeah, Konstantin. Is he here?" He gave a big smile.
"Yes, he sure is. For that's me, man. You are the England guy, right?"
I nodded and smiled, holding back laughter as he tried to match his speech with his dress sense. It just didn't work, especially with a Russian accent. He beamed as he looked me up and down.
"Okay, smart guy. Come on in."
He was right. I didn't look as if I'd come straight from the dry cleaners. Or maybe he'd been expecting a man in a bowler hat. The grill was secured from the inside with 2 lever locks. As soon as I'd walked in, both the door and the grill were locked behind me and the keys taken out. He held up his hands.
"Hey, call me Vorsim."
He wiggled his fingers, or rather the ones that hadn't gone missing, in the air.
"Everyone does. It's Russian for 8.
He gave me another quick once-over as we both smiled at the joke he'd probably cracked 1,000 times.
"Hey, follow me, England guy."
I followed 8 up a narrow wooden staircase to the first floor. The banisters and handrails were bare wood, and the exposed steps sagged with age. There was no light apart from the dull glow coming through the ground floor windows. I could only just see where my feet were going. It was an old, once grand house. I couldn't see any evidence of a bar, but at least it was warm and dry. Almost too dry. It had that dusty smell places get when the windows are never opened and the heating is on all the time. Our footsteps echoed round the stairwell. 8 was about 3 steps above me, wearing a pair of the most blindingly yellow and purple Nike trainers I'd ever seen, beneath a pair of baggy blue hip-hop-style jeans that were stonewashed, the kind with big, horrible streaks of white, and a black PVC leather-look bomber jacket with the LA Raiders pirate logo stitched on the back. We hit a landing and turned for the next flight, which would take us up to the 2nd floor. Weak light filtered through the slatted shutters. All the doors leading off it were panelled, with faded flowers painted on ceramic doorknobs. It must have been a splendid place when it was first built. We passed the 2nd and carried on up to the 3rd floor, then walked along a larger landing. He opened one of the doors towards the river.
"Your name is Nick, right?"
"Yeah, that's right." I didn't return the eye contact as I walked past him into the room. I was too busy checking what I was walking into. There was just 1 bulb in the center of the room, producing the dingy, yellowy light I'd seen from outside. The very large room was in semi-darkness and was boiling hot. The only job the lighting did was expose a layer of cigarette smoke that clung to the high ceiling. There was a glow from the TV to my left, its volume set at low, with a body in front of it. Directly in front of me, about 15 meters away, was a single sash window, its shutters open in the hope of letting in a little natural light. The shutters on each side were still firmly closed. There were no carpets or wall hangings, just empty space. To my right, near a large marble fireplace, three men were seated on fancy chairs around what looked like an antique table with ornate legs. They were playing cards and smoking. Beside them, and to the right of the fireplace, was another door. The three heads at the table turned and stared as they sucked on their cigarettes. I nodded without any reaction from them at all. Then one of the guys said something and the other two guffawed and went back to their game. The door closed behind me. I looked at Eight, who was bobbing up and down with excitement.
Well, man,
arms moving around like a wrapper.
You hang here. Voicing won't be long. Things to do.
And with that, he placed the grill keys on the table and disappeared through the door near the fireplace. I looked over at the guy by the TV. The colour picture was a bit snowy, perhaps because it was perched on a chair with a coat hanger for an aerial. He was sat on a chair opposite, his nose nearly touching the screen, too engrossed to bother looking round at me. His aerial was giving out more light than the bulb in the ceiling. It was a mystery how the other guys could see their cards. No one offered me anywhere to sit, so I went over to the window to have a look outside. The floorboards creaked with every step I took. The card school, now behind me, just got back to mumbling to each other as they played. It was easy to see what went on here. Two sets of electronic display pharmaceutical scales sat under the table at this end of the room. Next to them were stacked maybe 10 to 12 large Tupperware boxes, some containing white stuff that definitely wasn't flour. Others holding dark-coloured pills that similarly weren't Smarties. Directly beneath the window was Viru. Dirty snow and ice covering overflowing dustbins. At the corner of the building, three scabby cats lay perfectly still in the snow, gathered around a drain, waiting for their black, furry dinner to serve itself up. Over the lip of the gorge, the river on both banks was iced up. But the centre third was carrying big chunks of ice and garbage sluggishly from right to left, towards the Baltic about 12 km downstream. Further upstream, the bridge was still jammed with cars and people. I turned back to the room. It might be sweltering in here, but I was desperate for a hot brew. The only drink I could see was a bottle of Johnny Walker on the table, which was being emptied by the card players. They all had black leather jackets draped over the backs of their chairs. They'd obviously watched too many gangster movies, because they were all dressed in black trousers and black crew-neck jumpers, with enough gold dripping off their wrists and fingers to clear Estonia's national debt. It looked like a scene from Goodfellas. Packs of Camel and Marlboro lay on the table in front of them. Gold lighters placed neatly on top. I made sure they couldn't see my Lion King watch. I didn't want them to start by taking the piss, as there might be a time when they had to take me seriously. A smiling Disney character on my wrist wouldn't help. I turned to the TV watcher as he clicked at his lighter and lit up, holding the cigarette between his thumb and index finger, then leaning forward, elbows on knees, to get his nose back into some low-budget American soap. What was really strange was that the dialogue was still in English. Only after the actors had delivered their lines did the Russian dubbing take place. There was absolutely no emotion in the translation. A woman with more makeup than Eddie Izzard gushed, "But, Fortman, I love you." Then a Russian voice translated it as if she was buying a kilo of cabbage. I suddenly knew where Eight got his English and dress code from. The door opened, and in he came.
"Yo, Nikolai."
The bomber jacket was now off to reveal a red sweatshirt with Bart Simpson karate kicking another kid with fistfuls of dollars. Printed underneath was, "Just take it." Dangling from Eight's neck was a thick gold chain that any rapper would be proud of. He came and stood by the window with me.
"Nick, I've been told to help you. Because, hey, guess what, crazy guy? I'm the only one here who speaks English."
He shuffled from trainer to trainer as he clapped his hands. The good fellows looked at him as if he was a basket case and got back to their game.
Vorsim, I need a car. Car? Whoa, could be a problem, my man.
I half expected to hear his response followed by some bad Russian dubbing. He turned to the good fellows, spoke some very fast stuff and did some mock begging. The oldest one, maybe in his early 50s, didn't look up from his hand, but replied really aggressively. He must have been drinking liquid nasty instead of Johnny Walker. I caught his drift, though. Tell the Brit to fuck offski. I wondered if I should produce the insurance policy, but decided not to. Better to save it until it really mattered. Another one of the three sparked up with an idea, pointing first at 8, then at me, and made out he was hitting something with a hammer. The other two really liked that one. Even the TV addicts joined in, as they all had a good laugh. It was Merlin's laugh. King Arthur used to get frustrated when he made a kingly decision and his wizard just laughed, because Merlin knew the future and the king didn't. I felt the same sort of thing was happening here. Liv was right. Don't trust them an inch. 8's shoulders slumped. He walked back over to me.
I'll have to give you my car.
Is it one of the ones outside? I'd already guessed, but was hoping I was wrong.
Yes, but hey, man, I need it for bitches. Will I get it back soon? How long do you need it for? A couple of hours?
I shrugged. Maybe a couple of days. Before he could react, I added, I also want to see you later tonight. Will you be here?
Cool. I'm always here. I live here, my man.
He pointed up at the loft. Rather him than me. Okay, I'll be back later. Will your friends be here?
Oh, sure, Nikolai. They'll hang for a while. Business to do, people to see.
I put my forefinger and thumb together and shook my hand. Keys?
Keys? Oh, sure, sure. I'll have to come with you, my man. Show you something cool.
He ran through to the other room. The good fellows ignored me completely as I waited, concentrating instead on throwing more liquid nasty down their necks. 8 reappeared, pulling on his bomber jacket and zipping it up as he took the keys off the table. We went downstairs and out into the cold. After locking the door and grill behind us, it turned out that the cool thing he wanted to show me was that I'd have to hit the starter motor with a hammer before it would turn over. He said he liked it busted like this because no one could steal it. While he was busying himself, showing me what to do, it was pointless talking about licenses or whatever if I got stopped. I just wanted to get away from here and do my job. I didn't have time to fuck about. The Maliskaya knew the NSA were out and about and would be moving location any day now. But 8 wanted to remove his speakers and music first. I looked at the cassettes as he piled them on the passenger seat. There was an array of American rap bands I'd never heard of, all following 8's lead in the gold chain department, plus some really hip Russian artists who looked as though they were on the way to a reunion of the Jason King fan club. It was the white tuxedos that really gave them class. I was waiting for him to disconnect the speakers when a 5-series BMW, with a hint of silver beneath the dirt, cruised down the road from the direction I had walked. I noticed the plates first because they were British, P-Reg, and it was right-hand drive. Then I looked at the driver. The subconscious never forgets, especially when it comes to trouble. Carpenter. I couldn't believe it. As if he hadn't fucked up my life enough these past couple of weeks. He was slowing down as a van approached from the opposite direction, but it wasn't to let him past. He was heading over to where we were, and if he saw me, I bet I wouldn't be getting the Russian for, "Hail, good fellow. Well met." I jumped into the back of the car with 8 and made as if to help him pull out the speakers, my knees badly creasing up his newspapers. The BMW pulled into the car park, its tyres crunching louder and louder on the ice the closer it got. I suddenly found the speakers very interesting indeed and made sure my arse faced very definitely towards the BMW. I was feeling extremely vulnerable. but not as much as I would if he saw me. The engine shut down, and the driver's door opened. 8 was the other side of me and glanced over my shoulder as Carpenter's door slammed, then turned back to his beloved speakers. After hearing the wooden door close, I was still pulling out some very dodgy wiring as I asked, "Who's the English guy?"
"It's not England, you crazy guy,"
he tutted into the air.
"So why has he got an England car?"
I'd obviously said something very funny.
"Because he can, my man. Some England guy isn't going to St. Petersburg just to get his car back. That would be crazy, man."
"Oh, I see."
In this part of the world, it obviously didn't matter if you drove around with a hot car's plates on show. After all, if you had the money to have a BMW stolen to order, why not flaunt it? I could see the dealer's sticker in the rear window. It was a firm in Hanover, Germany, which probably meant that some British squaddy had been saving up for ages to buy his tax-free bargain, only to get it lifted so it could rumble around Narva in the snow. The first speaker came free. I had no idea how he was going to wire it up again. It looked like a telephone junction box in there. The chain around his neck made a curiously tinny noise as he moved around. The rap bands probably had the real thing, but I was sure his bitches never knew the difference.
"Who is he, then?"
"Oh, just one of the guys. Business, you know?"
He must do a lot of business here to have his own set of house keys.
"Don't say anything about me to anyone, Vorsim," I said. "Especially guys like him. I don't want people to know I'm here, okay?"
"Oh, sure, my man."
The way he said it was too blasé for my liking, but I didn't want to push the point. Once the speakers were out, I virtually threw the cassettes at him, wanting to get away before Carpenter reappeared. The bonnet was still open, and I gave the starter motor a seeing to with a hammer. 8 stood by the door holding an armful of cassettes with the speakers on the doorstep.
"Be careful with the bitch machine, Nikolai."
Before he'd even turned to unlock the door, I had the bonnet down, the engine in gear, and was away, heading back the way I'd come. My head was churning over about Carpenter. What if he was still there when I came back to see 8 after I'd done the recce? Or if he arrived while I was in the house? I'd fucked up in my attempt to get out of the way so quickly. I should have told 8 I wanted to meet elsewhere. I had to control a rage that was brewing inside me as I thought about Carpenter's drugged-up, fucked-up work that night. It had not only cost me money, but nearly got me killed. Should I even go back and see 8 again? I had no choice. I was going to need help obtaining explosives or whatever else I needed. I drove past the comfort bars, thinking of my professional options and what I would unprofessionally really like to do about him. Fuck it. I pulled into the border crossing car park. It took about a minute to work out how to secure the larder, as the driver's door lock was knackered. With the starter motor persuader in my pocket, I turned and began to walk back to the house. As the saying so rightly goes, there's not much you can't sort out with a 2-pound ball hammer. Chapter 32. I would have to luck it out and wait for him to leave the house, setting myself a cut-off of 2 o'clock the following morning. I still needed time to get on with the recce. Lifting Carpenter and keeping him tied up somewhere until the job was finished wasn't an option. There was no time for that. Now I'd got my bearings in this part of town, I cut between apartment blocks and saw some of the worst conditions yet. Sheds burned out to match the cars and buildings that should have fallen down years ago. There was still an hour and a half to go before last light at about 3:30, but the overcast sky was making everything darker than it should have been. Following the ice tracks in the snow, I turned corners and walked around car wrecks and rusty prams until the house came into view. Carpenter's BMW was no more than 30 meters away. The other 3 vehicles were also still there, all with a thin layer of ice forming on the windows and top surfaces. 1 or 2 people were walking around, but just from block to block, some accompanied by little dogs with knitted coats on. It was dark and cold enough for me not to be noticed as I stood inside what was left of one of the sheds, leaning against the wall with my head down, my hands in my jacket pockets, the right one grasping the hammer. I felt no apprehension, no emotion at all about what was coming. Some kill because they have a good reason. Others, like Carpenter, because they just like it. For me, it wasn't that deep. I did it only when I had to. Flexing my toes and my boots to keep the circulation going, I tried to think of other options, but still couldn't come up with any. There were more important things at stake than this maniac's life. I thought back to the sobs from the man in the lift in Helsinki as he held his dying wife. Carpenter could fuck everything up if he discovered I was here. I was still pissed off with myself for not switching on with 8 and asking for a change of meeting place. Because of that fuck-up, I'd got myself into a position where I could land up dead myself if I messed this up. One or two more dull yellow lights came on in the apartments. The noise of a TV hung in the air as a car rattled along the road. Then I heard a baby screaming. I continued with my trigger on the door, listening to the occasional bang of pots and pans from behind steamed-up kitchen windows and their sagging, dirty net curtains. Somewhere in the neighborhood, dogs barked at each other, probably just out of boredom. No sign of movement or light came from the house. Lion King said it was 3:12. Still, I watched and waited, feeling the cold attacking my ears and nose, wishing I'd made the effort and bought a replacement hat and gloves. I got another 4 aspirin down me as my body started reminding me that it had taken a good kicking the night before. I spent long minutes trying to get enough saliva in my mouth to swallow them. Another check of Lion King, 3:58. I hadn't even been here an hour yet, but it felt like 6. I always hated the waiting. Another 30 minutes crawled by. Then there was movement at the door, a dull, yellowish glow at the grill. Slowly I took my hands from my pockets, taking a firm hold of the hammerhead in my right hand. I laid the handle along my forearm on the outside of my jacket. 2 men were standing there smoking, waiting to come out once they'd opened the grill. In the glow from the cigarettes and the hall light, their breath vapor was indistinguishable from the smoke as it rose above them. I couldn't make out if either of them was Carpenter. I hope not. Taking on 2 with a hammer would not make for a good night out, and Carpenter was bound to be armed. They continued to talk as the grill squeaked open, and one of them came out onto the ice. The grill was then closed, leaving one of them on each side. Maybe it was going to be okay. Whoever was leaving had a quick laugh with his mate, who now looked like a prisoner behind bars. Then, as he walked away, he pushed the wooden door closed, rubbing his hands together against the cold. From this distance, I couldn't hear the bolts being thrown. He looked like a Yorkshire vet. I could make out the shape of a flat cap as he moved to the vehicles. I still couldn't tell if it was Carpenter. The man moved towards the 5 series that was parked side on to me, facing the house. Then there was a jangle of keys. I still couldn't identify him. I would have to get closer. He'd be there a while, scraping the ice from the windscreen. My legs were feeling rubbery after so long standing still. Stretching, I moved out of the darkness, trying to pump a bit of blood around. There were only about 20 meters separating us, but as he neared the BM, I still couldn't be sure it was him. The car door opened, and the interior light shone across his back as he leaned in and started up the engine. Exhaust fumes filled the air as he shoved 1 leg inside and hit the gas. Then he turned the headlights on. They shone brightly away from both of us, but silhouetted his profile. I recognized Carpenter at once. I took 1 last look around me to make sure the area was clear. From this moment on, I'd be concentrating solely on the target. It was now 10 meters away, hopefully with the engine noise hiding my movement. He was focusing on the windscreen, his back to me still as he leaned over to clear the ice. My eyes never left his head as it moved back and forth in a cloud of breath. He must have heard me and started to turn. I was no more than 5 meters away, but too far to react quickly. I just had to keep walking, but now veering slightly left, as if I was heading for the road. I got my head down, not wanting to look at him as I approached the rear of the car, my hands under my armpits, concealing my weapon. I had to assume that he was checking out the dickhead who thought he could ponce around in this weather without a hat and gloves. The focus of my whole world was on this man, waiting to hear the noise of the scraper again. I was nearly past him, just approaching the BM's boot, when it finally began again. Scrape, scrape, scrape. It was time to look up and find his head once again as it bobbed up and down in time with the noise. Scrape, scrape, scrape. Supporting the hammerhead in my left hand, I ran my hand down the handle and gripped it hard. At that moment, he looked up again, towards the road. I too saw the four white DTTS Vitaras screech to a halt outside an apartment block on the other side of the road. I had no choice but to keep walking past him as black-clad bodies jumped out of the vehicles and ran into the building, leaving the drivers standing outside, nightsticks in hand. I got to the road and turned left towards the roundabout, not once looking behind me. I could hear screams and the sound of smashing glass as the DTTS team did whatever they did in apartment blocks of an afternoon. I was cursing to myself, but at the same time feeling lucky they hadn't turned up a few seconds later. What concerned me now was that he could be there when I returned to the house for any kit I might need. I took the first opportunity to turn left again off the road and back into the blocks as the BM drove past me, heading for the roundabout. I drove out of town, heading west and following signs along the Tallinn Road to a place called Kotla Järve, about 35 kilometres away. The road didn't hold any surprises for me. The car bumped all over the place, slithering over the different levels of tarmac under the ice and slush. I couldn't complain. I was just happy to have got the thing started again. I went through a couple of small towns, trying to avoid the bus and truck drivers who wanted me to join their death race. This was supposed to be dual carriageway, but it didn't work out like that. Everyone took the centre of the road because that was where there was less ice and more tarmac. Seeing signs for Vuka, I made a mental note of the time since leaving Narva. I'd be wanting that road later. The wipers were slapping away ineffectually against the shit that was being sprayed up by trucks and dumped on our smaller vehicles. I had to keep stopping, using the newspaper from the back seat to wipe the windows. At one stage, I even had to piss over the windscreen to clear the icy grime, trying to avoid the splash as the wipers did their stuff before it froze once again. Kotla Järve, it appeared, was the home of the giant, brooding slag heaps and long conveyor belts I'd seen from the train. Bright, white lights spilled from factories on either side of the road as I duelled with my trucker friends. They eventually dwindled with the industry, and soon there was complete darkness, apart from kamikaze trucks and bus lights on full beam, mixed with cars with only one light trying to overtake the lot of us. I followed the road west for about another 20 kilometres, then turned left, heading south for a place called Pussy. I was in no mood for gags. Otherwise, I might have passed the time wondering where it might be twinned with. In the larder's headlights, I could see that the road was single track and hadn't been used or cleared for quite a while. There were just two tire ruts worn into the snow. It was going to be like riding on rails. It was another 20 km further south to the target. There had to be a quicker way of doing it than driving a right-angled box, west and then south, but I didn't know how accurate the maps were. Besides, I wanted to stay on the mains as long as possible, and then I could at least be sure of getting there. I was feeling quite pleased with myself, considering I had no map. One of the muggers in Tallinn was probably wiping his arse with it right now. The headlights reached about 5 to 10 metres either side of me, exposing banks of snow and the occasional ice-laden tree waiting to spark up in the spring. I drove through Pussy, which looked like a small farming community. The buildings were run-down shacks made of bare, unpainted wood and surrounded by wrecked cars. The roofs were bowed in with age or bad construction. Most had two lengths of wood with strips going across to form a ladder, permanently attached as a means of getting the snow off. By the look of it, the timbers would have collapsed without them. I reckoned this was the place for eight, without a doubt. A hand-painted larder would be the ultimate passion wagon in this neck of the woods. They had electricity, because there was the occasional glint of light coming through the curtains of very small windows, and a dull bulb shone in the back of a barn. But there obviously wasn't running water, because I kept seeing the sort of communal hand pump that Clint Eastwood used to strike a match on to light his panatella. These ones, however, were wrapped up in tarpaulin and bits of rag to stop them freezing. The chimney stacks were going for it big time. They must have been chopping logs all summer. There were no warning signs that I was about to bump over the railway track from Tallinn, and after that I didn't see a single sign of human activity. The road got steadily worse. The larder slid all over the place and didn't enjoy the potholes one bit now that my own personal snow railway had come to an end. I checked the odometer, counting down to the only T-junction, which, if I remembered rightly, was a couple of K's away. Once there, I at last got help. A small sign told me it was right to Tudu. I turned left, now knowing that the target would be the first building on the left after 2 more kilometres. Just after 2 K's, a high concrete wall appeared in my headlights, about 10 metres in on the left-hand side. I drove slowly for another 40 metres or so, encountering a pair of large metal gates the same height as the wall. I drove past them, and the wall continued for about another 40 metres before it turned at a right angle into the darkness. The second building, just a bit further on and maybe 30 metres in length, resembled a large hangar. It was slightly closer to the road and wasn't fenced or walled in. I waited until I'd rounded a bend and was physically out of line of sight of the target. Then I threw the larder into a little driveway on my left, stopping after a 3-foot slide. It was probably an entrance to a field or something, but it wasn't as if people were going to be working on the land for a few more months. I closed the door quietly onto its first click, then the second, and used the wipers to secure a sheet of newspaper over the windscreen. I started to walk back down the road, trying to keep warm by moving as fast as I could, and sticking to the ice that had formed on the road to keep footprints to a minimum. I didn't have a clue what I was going to do yet. Chapter 33. After 2 hours of straining my eyes to see the road through a dirty, smeared windscreen, it was taking a while for my night vision to kick in. A bird screeched in the distance, but there were no other sounds apart from my own breathing and the crunch of my boots on the ice. I found I had to step quite gingerly. So much for warming up. By the time I'd reached the target, the rods in my eyes had realized there was no ambient light and they had to get to work. Not that I could miss the first building, just off the road to my right. The gap of 5 meters or so in between them was knee-deep with snow, covering the fallen brickwork that had spilled out across the verge. It was, or had been, quite a substantial building, though most of the masonry had collapsed, exposing what I supposed was the steel frame. I could see right through it to the field beyond. It was one story, lower than the concrete wall further along, but very wide and with a low angled pitched roof covered with a thick layer of snow. A very tall chimney stack, resembling a ship's funnel, soared out of the roof on the right-hand side and disappeared into the darkness. Continuing towards the concrete wall, I crossed the 10 meters or so between the hangar and the target compound. As I approached, I began to make out the dark shape of a normal-sized door set in the concrete wall. I'd have loved to have gone and tried it, but I couldn't risk leaving tracks in the deep snow. As I walked on towards the gates, the front wall towered above me. There was no lights pushing skywards from the compound and no noise. I tried looking for CCTV cameras or intruder devices, but it was too dark and the wall was too high and far away. If there were any, I'd soon find out. A depressing thought hit me. I hoped they hadn't changed location already. I moved the 40 meters or so it took to reach the point where the compound driveway joined the road. Turning right, I started to walk to the gates. It was pointless skulking about. I just had to get on with it. The depression didn't lift when I failed to see light spilling out from under the gates as I got closer. As I slowly closed in on them, keeping within the right-hand tyre rut, I began to see that the wall was constructed of enormous concrete blocks, maybe 25 meters long and at least 3 to 5 meters high. There must have been a fair thickness for them to rest on top of each other like that. They looked as if they should be laid flat, end to end, to construct a runway. I still couldn't see anything that even resembled CCTV or alarms. The two large gates were as high as the wall itself. I was right up against them now and still couldn't hear anything on the other side. The gates were made of steel plate with a thick coating of dark anti-oxide paint, which was smooth to the touch, without a trace of blistering or flaking. I could also see white chalk markings, the sort scored on to guide the welder. I gently pushed against them both, but they didn't move, and there were no locks or chains I could see holding them in position. They were newly made, but judging by the exposed reinforcement rods jutting out of the crumbling concrete, the wall wasn't. Set into the right gate was a smaller pedestrian door. It had two locks, one a third of the way up from the bottom and another a third of the way down from the top. I gently pulled the door handle, which, of course, was also locked. The gap between gate and ground was 4 to 6 inches. Lying down slowly on my side and using the length of the tyre rut to avoid making prints in the snow either side of me, I pressed my eye against the gap. I could feel the frozen ground under my body as it made contact, but that no longer mattered. There was light on the other side. I became aware, too, of the gentle hum of machinery. I couldn't be sure, but it was probably a generator. I made out the shapes of two buildings about 60 meters away. The smaller one on the left had two lights shining from ground-floor windows. Their patterned curtains were drawn, but light still spilled onto the snow in front of the building. The noise must be a jenny. There wasn't enough wattage in this country to penetrate curtains. The building was too far away for me to notice anything else about it. It was just a dark shape on a dark background. I studied the larger building to the right. There was a dark area in the middle front of the building, its rectangular shape with a semicircular top suggesting a large access.